Refugee resettlement agencies in Northern California were anticipating the announcement this week by the Trump administration that the number of refugee admissions to the United States will now be set at its lowest in almost 40 years. On Insight, I'll talk with representatives from two regional groups that work with refugees and their families. The groups are Opening Doors and the Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services. Then, some choices for your weekend, starting with a one-woman show about Albert Einstein at the State Theater in Auburn. The story is told from the perspective of Einstein's secretary. In Carmichael, it's the 35th season of the Italian Film Festival. It kicks off with a showing of Cinema Paradiso. Bob Mazzullo is here. And then at the Red Museum in Sacramento this weekend, the Red X Volume 2 Festival will preview it in Sound Advice. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's Today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Sacramento has the largest refugee resettlement center in the United States. Did you know that? More than 5,200 refugees came into the county last year. But the Trump administration announced this week that the new fiscal year beginning October 1st would see a change in that number. The number now admitted into the United States nationally will be limited to 30,000, and that's the lowest number in more than 38 years. It is, of course, expected to impact what happens in this Northern California region. Here's a bit of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's message. This is from his announcement on Monday.
The United States anticipates processing up to 310,000 refugees and asylum seekers in fiscal year 2019. We propose resettling up to 30,000 refugees under the new refugee ceiling, as well as processing more than 280,000 asylum seekers. They will join the over 800,000 asylum seekers who are already inside the United States and who are awaiting adjudication of their claims.
I'm going to give you a few more numbers, and I realize it's a lot of numbers, but we'll give some human context to this in a moment. Last year, the cap on admissions was 45,000, and that had been the lowest number going back to 1980. But the U.S. reportedly didn't even meet that number. Only about 21,000 refugees were admitted. In the studio with me now are representatives of two different agencies that work with refugees in our area. Deborah Ortiz is CEO of the group Opening Doors. Hi, Deborah. It's always a pleasure to have you here
in the
studio.
Thank you for having me, Beth.
And from Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services, the Director of Family Services is Genevieve Levy. And Genevieve, glad to welcome you back to
Thank you.
To
Good
Insight.
To see you, Beth.
So give me some reaction to this announcement. It wasn't a surprise. Was the specific number a surprise, Deborah?
We anticipated a low number. We never know what how low the number is, but 30,000 we were not surprised. It certainly is, as you noted, the lowest number in history, and it certainly doesn't reflect the 62 million or so displaced across the world and the 22.5 that have already been million that have already been classified as refugees. So when you compare that with what the U.S. is agreeing to accept, but we know will not actually arrive based on this last year, it's really profoundly disheartening.
Does that mean there will be a big drop in resettlements in this region, or because the center is so big, will there still be quite a sizable number?
Well, you mentioned the less than 45,000 that had been approved this last fiscal year, that barely 21,000 had been resettled. Our region has been hit significantly. We saw some large arrivals in the first quarter, but our organization is about at 54% of what we were told we were going to receive. And these are refugees who had been vetted, who had been cleared, who had been authorized. But that last final piece of allowing them to be provided a visa has not been afforded. So we have at least 50% less than what we were told that we're going to arrive. And we are hearing from people afar saying we're not being able to travel, that final step.
Genevieve, say a bit about what Opening Doors does, where in the process your organization is.
So refugee resettlement is the first 90 days, which there are five organizations in our region. So that's sort of that really critical front end kind of pick them up at the airport, get them settled, get them enrolled, their children enrolled in school, help them find access to resources. And then we have many post 90 days, as all of our organizations do. And we also have programs that help immigrants, undocumented immigrants. So immigration legal services, case management for survivors of human trafficking. We have literacy programs and ESL classes. We're a micro lender. We do micro loans for small businesses, over 2.7 million. So we have an array of services. This program was the origin of our organization, and we have since branched out to post 90 days. But this is the most critical, I think, that is the core of most of our services.
And now, Genevieve, at what point might an individual or a family come to Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services and say, okay, now what? Now where do I go?
So in all of those steps along the way, too. So we're the newest of the five agencies here in Sacramento. We've only been doing resettlement since the beginning of 2015. It's a tremendous fit to our organization in terms of being able to help individuals with their immediate needs.
Right.
Like Deborah mentioned, with resettlement, finding housing, getting them connected to services, and then helping towards self-sufficiency and financial independence with becoming that, hopefully self-sufficient, getting connected to job resources and things like that. We've seen a tremendous increase in the refugee and newcomer populations utilizing all of our programs and services beyond just resettlement. I mentioned we're very small comparison with, I know, Opening Doors, over 1,000 last year, and some of the larger partners in the region, IRC and World Relief, almost at 2,000. We resettled 200. So we're very much smaller, but a partner in this work. We're seeing lots of families coming to our English classes, parenting classes, utilizing our food resources. It's been really great to see some of our food partner agencies wanting information on what culturally appropriate food should I be serving our new customers and clients. So it's just been a change in the region, and we're happy to embrace the clients in all of our programs.
Genevieve, to be specific about it, your program seeing an increase in attendance doesn't necessarily reflect what's happening in terms of resettlement in the area. It may just mean that people are plugging into the services.
For sure. For sure. Something that's really unique about Sacramento, and not to confuse everyone with like more numbers and different terms and everything.
Well, this is a complex picture that we're trying to outline.
So outside of refugees are also another category of individuals called special immigrant visa holders, SIVs.
Right,
right now, primarily are coming from Afghanistan. Prior have been from Iraq. And these folks have worked with U.S. military overseas, often in combat as translators, working directly with chief of commission at the embassies. As I mentioned, right alongside troops, we have civil engineers, electrical engineers, drivers, security guards. So have done the work with U.S. They go through another application process, security clearance process, more extreme than the refugee vetting. They get this other type of visa, special immigrant visa, and then they're funneled into the refugee resettlement process. So they are assigned to our agencies just like refugees, although they are not refugees. So I try to use sometimes newcomer to kind of encompass everyone that we see here in Sacramento. But that has actually been what's been keeping a lot of our agencies, afloat, it was probably the right word, or making us the biggest receiving community in the U.S., is that Sacramento is a magnet community right now and has been the last 3 years for Afghan special immigrant visa holders. They want to come here to Sacramento.
What happened that Sacramento became this big dot on the map, Deborah?
Well, I like to tell the story about when my grandparents came to Sacramento from the state of Jalisco in the 30s. A family settles. The family back home says, where's a welcoming place? And they have that conversation, not unlike that experience. So that's why Sacramento early families were mostly from the state of Jalisco, this region where my grandparents are from. So that is the same story that happens with the Afghan community awaiting arrival. On top of that, they also realized...
Wait a minute. Are you saying at some point Afghan refugees started to come here and then said, this area works, there are services, and more came?
There are jobs.
Mm-hmm. And a relatively affordable cost of living, which is... Some of them may have earlier settled in L.A. or San Diego. We see that we have surpassed L.A. for that reason. We're just slightly below San Diego. But that experience over the last 3 to 4 years, starting with Iraqi special immigrant visa holders that preceded the large Afghan, there's that conversation across those communities that it's a welcoming community, mm-hmm. it's an affordable community. So
as
it's
opposed to a government agency designating Sacramento or deciding to build a center
they
here?
They self-designate.
Yeah, so they the U.S. primarily, I want to say it's like 95% are U.S. Thai-based resettlement. So you have to pick a friend, a family member, a coworker, a neighbor, a relative that you know. And we as resettlement agencies have to make contact with that person and say, can they come? Yes or no? It doesn't mean that that friend, the U.S. has to help, but just is willing to sort of be part of that welcoming. And so it has really created the snowball in the last 4 years, like every wave of immigration ever. So you go where your friends and your neighbor and your cousin are. It's really common right now for us to resettle somebody. We have two Afghan SIV staff, for example. We hired the staff because we had to serve more of the community. We needed the language capacity. They were both translators, lawyers in Afghanistan, speak five languages. Easy, quick hire. They have been the U.S. Thai then for three or four other families just since they arrived 3 years ago.
To what degree are you assisting people who are in the pipeline, or does your work only begin once they've been approved and they arrive by plane?
I can speak for our agency. We are, it's a little complex. There are nine NGOs, non-government organizations, that work with the U.S. State Department. They are set, they are told you'll have 30,000 and then you go, they essentially divide up what the numbers that they will administer. And then they let us, the local affiliates, know you're going to get 1,000 people this year. And that process is that, you know, the refugees self-select once they're vetted and cleared. And word of mouth or by whatever means, we basically are told you're going to receive X number of people in the next week, this family size. And we then kick into gear and start to look for apartments and all these things. And
yeah, it's primarily once they arrive, but you have to kind of prepare at least a couple weeks in advance. We, on occasion, will get communication from someone overseas that has already decided to come and says, I want you. And they're starting to send emails and communicate in English. And we see them a couple weeks later. So we have been in communication with clients ahead of arrival, but there isn't any role as such with our organizations in choosing or advocacy in any way. We are receiving them when they get here.
That is Genevieve Levy. She's Director of Family Services for the Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services. We'll post a link on our website if you're hearing something that you need more information about. Also in the studio with me, Deborah Ortiz, the CEO of the group Opening Doors. So getting back to the announcement Monday, what impact is that going to have here?
Well, I will say that our organization, we have, again, we received 53% or 55% of what we were told we were going to receive and we budgeted for. And that's the realization is I sort of acknowledge that we need to presume that the arrivals will be nominal at best.
And so you have much more capacity than people here to take advantage of that capacity.
Well, it just means that we're not going to be doing resettlement and we're going to be doing other programs. We may get one or two. They may trickle in. But I don't think we have any expectations that we're going to see the numbers return to anything like this last year. By the end of this month, which will be the end of the fiscal year, we probably will have settled 545 out of what we were told would be 968.
Wow.
And so that we have to assume that that 545 or whatever is probably going to be much higher than what we'll get in the next fiscal year.
I am just seeing recent numbers, 2017 numbers. Mm-hmm. Can you take me back? And I'm looking for whether there was a dramatic shift from the end of the Obama presidency into the beginning of the Trump administration. Did the numbers change for you regionally?
So I joined.
It was timed with the also increase of the SIVs. So the timing of sort of leaving Iraq and then the issuing of a lot of the Afghan SIV visas and the desire to come to Sacramento. I think all of those things kind of were happening on a trajectory the last 3 years.
But so yes. I think 2014 was when we started to see a pickup in Afghan special immigrant visa holders really increased. Late 15, but definitely 2016, 2017. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, we had some Iraqi persons who helped our government, our military. They were also SIVs. The alignment with the Obama administration, what was his peak authorization?
75 to 80, and that was what was sort of being predicted for the future administration. And then when things had changed, yeah, it's sort of been a surprise every year what it's going
to
look like.
And I think it's important to point out that even though the approved number to arrive last year was 45,000, we have seen these bureaucratic delays and no official statutory cutting of these numbers. The travel ban overlay did not directly affect Afghan SIVs, which are the bulk of our clients. However, we saw these delays. They simply were bureaucratically delaying them. So we assume that even if they're and in this most recent announcement, presidential determination, which is done before October 1, the president is supposed to confer with Congress. That did not occur. So between a combination of administrative delays by design, I think some ignoring or thwarting regulatory processes, the net result is really we cannot anticipate, at least our organization, many arrivals at all in the next fiscal year.
I'm looking through some statistics. The highest number of U.S. admissions was actually under President Reagan.
200,000.
Over 200,000. Yeah. I don't have a specific year on that. But let's get to a few basics. Mm-hmm. If a refugee and his or her family has settled, this new number, the change in policy at the moment, doesn't affect them at all, does it?
No. So refugees are authorized to work. They have a work visa for 1 year, and they can apply for their green card after 1 year and then for citizenship 5 years after that. SIVs have about a 1 year head start. So they are actually legal permanent residents, green card holders at the port of entry. They've got to wait hopefully a couple weeks to get that green card in the mail. But our SIVs are legal permanent residents when they get here. So we're also expecting, given this recent wave of SIVs over the last 3 years, in the next 2 years, a hopeful wave of citizenship naturalization applications coming up, too.
And upon initial arrival, you need a place to stay. And it sounds like early on in the process, it's there's an effort to plug family into language services, somehow into some translation learning of English. So again, the groups that deal with that very first step, Deborah, are?
Well, our caseworkers, our staff, basically, meet and our volunteers meet them at the airport, have an apartment set up, take them to qualify for public benefits or Social Security if they're disabled, help them enroll their children in school as a condition of their public benefits. You know, the primary person in the household, you know, has to either improve their English and or be actively seeking employment. The males mostly speak English because they work with our government. We have a couple of programs that are designed for women. Many are pre-literate in their home country because they weren't allowed to be educated. We have a child care licensing program for refugee women in which at least 15 women a year start a small business in their homes doing child care. So right away, we have seen the statistics. The time on public assistance is far less, on average 9 months to 8 months, and that, you know, families are finding a way to socially integrate into our region and contribute to our region. So it's a sprint when they get here, and we help with that sprint. But, you know, there are lots of either required English language development classes or optional. We have another small program, pre-literacy for refugee women, with a partnership with the public library. So we have tools that are designed to fit these communities.
Yeah, the English learner program I know at Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services, which can also lead to a GED or any kind of educational programs, has been really popular for decades.
Yeah, it's been a really, I don't know, for me, it's an opportunity, not a challenge, to be able to serve this new community. So really happened organically to see the change in the demographics of the class. And we realized with this, the female student population, wow, we need to open a new lower level of class, because it wasn't for our beginner levels that had primarily been maybe Spanish speakers with a second or third grade education level, reading level. We were talking zero formal education, no written capability in native language because they had not been able to. And hearing directly from a mouth of one of my students through a translator, you know, thank you so much for this opportunity. I was not able to do this at home. We want to come here. We want to go to class, that we can do it now. We're allowed to.
Well, again, the numbers will shift sometime after the beginning of this next fiscal year, which is October 1st. And I think that just seeing a picture of this down the road, 6 months from now, what's happened, will say a lot in how the flow is to the Northern California region.
I wanted to offer one other thing because Deborah mentioned benefits. I do a lot of presentations out for community agencies, and sometimes folks are concerned about that, you know, this sort of impact on the economy. So did a little bit of research and found some data supporting that after a refugee has been in the United States for 20 years, they've paid over any benefit cost that was out to them, $21,000. Mm. Right now, what we're seeing, and this definitely supports who's coming to Sacramento, the working age of those are coming is the majority. So about 70% are working age, which is what we need given a lot of U.S.-born aging population. So just tremendous economic support. I mean, you could just find article after article about the benefit, the entrepreneurship of the refugee communities just across the country. And this is a tremendous loss to our nation.
Well, I tried to focus today not on the politics or the rightness or wrongness of the policy, but really on the process that happens here and the impact that it will have and has had in Sacramento. Again, we'll post links so that if people need to hear more or find more, they can on our website.
Yeah. There's one more call to action that one of our partners, World Relief Sacramento, posted yesterday. So I believe there is still time, supposedly, that maybe this isn't the final decision. I think we want to have hope in that. So it is to call your local representatives, or not your local representatives, call your congressional representatives and let them know that, you know, we, Sacramento, California, wants this community.
And I would just like to add, I mean, I echo that really call to action with the U.S. senators and congressional representatives asking that this issue be addressed. The other thing I want to say is Sacramento is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. We hear stories from across the country about not ideal welcoming of refugees. This community, across all faiths, across the business community, volunteers are just incredibly welcoming. And it's very heartwarming to see sort of the fabric of this community be so supportive of newcomers, refugees, immigrants. So I just really want to thank your listeners because they've been fabulous.
Deborah, Genevieve, thanks for joining us today. Deborah Ortiz is CEO of the group Opening Doors. Genevieve Levy is Director of Family Services at Sacramento Food Bank and Family Services. You can find those links to more information and more resources at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak, and we have a few weekend entertainment options to share with you for the rest of the hour, starting with an offbeat comedy about, of all people, Albert Einstein. It's being staged at the State Theater in Auburn Saturday night. The play takes place on what would have been Einstein's birthday. It's a one-woman show written and performed by actress Cress Mirsky, and she tells the story from the perspective of Einstein's secretary. Cress is on the phone now to tell us more. Hi, welcome back to Insight, Cress.
Oh, hi there. How are you?
First of all, where did your fascination with Albert Einstein come from?
Oh, gosh. Well, some years ago, I think like many millions of other folks around the world, I just found him a compelling figure altogether on so many levels. I think his humanitarian, his efforts, his simply his mind. I think just there was an individual who was able to envision the universe quite like no one else was. And I think to me that I don't have a science background. I'm a theater person. That was my whole orientation from 14 years old. But this was just particularly compelling to me that there was someone who could just think so differently about things. And
Cress, you are in the role of the person who was his real-life secretary,
yes,
right?
Yes, this is true.
Do you call her Helen or Helene? Because I think she went by both names.
Well, actually, I have kind of changed the name. I've taken some theatrical liberties with the piece. Her real name was Helen Dukas. the real secretary, and I am calling her Ellen Schoenhammer. There is always a great deal written about the secretary. In anything you'll read about her, Helen Dukas will always be mentioned, but they never go into her life at all. So it really required me in creating this piece to really read as much as I could possibly about her, and there still isn't a great deal about her. So I kind of had to imagine certain things about her life that I've later found out weren't too far off the mark about her. And so you could say in some manner it's loosely based on the actual woman who was Einstein's secretary, although I've really stayed as much to the historical facts as possible, as any playwright does. You know, you do change things to make it.
I don't know your full storyline, but I know with the play being set on the birthday, that does pick up on what became a habit, that reporters would check in and say, ah, it's Dr. Einstein's birthday. How is he celebrating today? So that's a jumping off point for you, isn't it?
Exactly. That was sort of a conceit of the piece that, oh, it'll be his birthday and reporters have gathered at his home to speak with him. And he's allowed a press conference for that. And so I carry that through different segments in his life. So you kind of go through his whole, well, his whole life since he arrived in America from escaping Nazi Germany, which is interesting. I'm listening to your last segment that you just had on the radio, and Einstein was a refugee. He was probably one of America's most famous refugees, and he also had struggled to get into this country. Not everyone wanted him here. And so the story goes into that, and you know, which is very relevant to obviously today's situation in our in the world, the refugee crisis. So I think that's exciting for me to be able to share that.
I'm talking with Cress Mirsky. She is the writer and performer of the one-woman play, The Life and Times of A. Einstein. It's this Saturday at the Auburn Placer Performing Arts Center at the State Theater in Auburn. The show is at 7:30. And this has been your niche, if I can say so, the one-woman solo type of show. I think it can be inherently challenging to do that, but maybe inherently freeing, too. Why do you choose this method?
Well, gosh, you know, I did, you know, I had a long career in film and television, over 20 years of working on episodic TV shows and in film and theater, primarily in Los Angeles. And I always, as a young actress, was led to certainly to Einstein. I also have another piece on the life and work of the mother of modern dance, Isadora Duncan, and another show that I do, a solo show of characters, different sort of these offbeat monologues and pieces that I've written. I don't know. I think as a young actress, too, I was just drawn to create stuff on my own, and then I began to take writing, playwriting much more seriously. I've also written full-length plays.
This one your first, though, this Einstein?
No, actually, Einstein was my third solo show. There were two others before, and the show I created in the 80s, and it had its first production here in Los Angeles with the Mark Taper Forum, and I've had several runs since then, and kind of been taking it on the road since then.
So what was your favorite TV show to be part of? One did you have the best experiences
in?
Oh,
golly. That's hard to say. Gosh, so many of them were challenging experiences.
One of your shows was Charlie's Angels,
oh, yes,
wasn't it?
Yes. Oh yes. And, I was on the first season of did an episode of that, playing a villain. Of course, you know, most of the guest stars were villains on a show like that.
And Revenge of the Nerds too.
Revenge of the Nerds. I played a mother of one of the kid. There was a little, you know, brilliant kid who went off to college early. I was his mother, and I think one of the a very rewarding opportunity I had was on the Richard Pryor show. Richard Pryor had a short-lived variety show, and he had hired me to come in and do one of my original characters, and I did that, which was really exciting, you know, to be asked to come and do on a television variety show, a rather dramatic piece, and that was very, very exciting.
Well, Chris, I think it's as much a fun opportunity for people to come and simply see you work as it is to see this piece of work, Einstein play. And in the great renovated State Theater will be a wonderful venue.
Yes, I'm excited to see the theater and perform there. Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you for taking a little bit of your time, and good luck with the show this weekend.
Yes,
nice to have you back in the area. And for the next one, come on into the studio, okay?
Yes, sure. Thank you.
All right. That is Chris Mirsky, and The Life and Times of A. Einstein is Saturday night at the State Theater in Auburn. There's more on our website at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A little more opportunity for some weekend entertainment. You don't need to know Italian or even be of Italian heritage to enjoy the Sacramento Italian Film Festival, but wow, terrific for you if you have that connection. This is a movie series that allows you to see a span of films, classics to modern, sometimes with English subtitles, sometimes entirely in English. And usually there's a bit of interesting discussion, something to eat and drink that goes along with it. It's the 35th season of the film festival, and it kicks off with a showing of the classic Cinema Paradiso tomorrow night at the Italian Cultural Center in Carmichael. Film director Bob Mazzullo is back with us again. He has a preview. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Beth.
Congratulations.
Nice to be back.
35 years. Wow.
Well, I haven't been doing it for 35 years, but the Italian Cultural Society has. Started out as a very small project. The Italian Cultural Center is a relatively new facility, but before they had that facility, they operated out of a classroom in the Sierra 2 Center. And I remember it was just a handful of people that would come out for that. Now it's a fairly big thing.
Now that you've had some extended experience watching films, I'm interested in how you define the difference between an Italian-made film and an American-made film. And, of course, the audiences are different. But what's the feeling you've come to understand?
I think the Italian films are a little bit more earthy. They are more about real life, I think, than most American films are. But, you know, that's a generalization. There's American films that are very down to earth, and there are Italian films that are pure fluff. The one we're starting with tomorrow night, Cinema Paradiso, or as most Americans say, Cinema Paradiso. Cinema is the Italian pronunciation. Is a delightful comedy about a film producer, a film director, who returns to his little town in Sicily, and he has lengthy conversations with the projectionist of the theater. The projectionist was played by Philip Noriette, the great French actor. He was the one that inspired this director to get into filmmaking, and they reminisce about movies. And if you love movies, this is a great film. If you love comedy, it's a great film. If you love just things about Italian situations, it's a great film. It did win both the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film and the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film.
It's in Italian with English subtitles.
Correct.
I love a great trailer, so here's a clip.
Cosa ci posso fare
io? Aspettate giù, e poi ci hanno mandato via.
Una folla non pensa, non sa quello che fa. Questo lo diceva il grande Spinger Tracy in furia. Allora, che dici? Ce lo facciamo vedere il film a queste povere pazze?
Magari, ma come? Si può fare?
So I'm just appreciating how the words get lengthened toward the end of the sentences, Bob. But you have this glisten.
It's almost like a song, isn't it?
It is very musical, but you have a glisten in your eye like you understand it. You're delighted by that clip because you know the movie.
Well, I wish I understood it better. I'm not a linguist. I have studied Italian for many years, but I'm far from mastering it.
So that is tomorrow night at the Italian Cultural Center, 8 o'clock.
8 p.m., yes, as all of our films are. And I should emphasize that the Italian Film Festival, unlike most other film festivals, is not 1 or 2 days with a whole bunch of films all at once. We spend, I think, 9 months of the year showing films periodically, always on a Friday night, usually the third Friday of the month, from September through May. Then we take a little break in the warmer months.
Over the holidays. So I'm going to go quickly to the next one, just saying that on Friday, October 26th, so before Halloween, is the English version of the title is The Children Are Watching Us. Would you just say the Italian version?
Yes, yes. It is called I Bambini Ci Guardano.
Okay, I'm going to move right on because I want to get through all the films because I have a clip for the film that is shown in January, the Il Comandante. Let's listen and we'll talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Salve.
E lui, Alex, stiamo facendo fisica.
Abbiamo venduto tutto.
Tutte le opere tranne la mia. Non vuole tenerla lei? Gliela lascio per la metà.
Sei cattivo, sei cattivo!
Ritiene efficaci questi metodi educativi?
Si faccia i fatti suoi.
So you don't even need to know Italian to know that's a comedy. That one's going to be great fun. In fact, it's hilarious,
it
isn't
it? Yes, and it's about a nice turn of events, a single father raising two teenage children. And he communicates with his deceased wife periodically for advice and occasional arguments about raising these two somewhat troublesome children.
See? Hilarious, right? I'm talking with Bob Mazzullo. He's film director for the Italian Film Festival, which kicks off tomorrow night and continues over a number of months. There are movies in February and April. The season finale is Friday, May 17th, with the whole shebang. So let's hear a bit of this one.
So you come here to blow yourself up, huh?
Yes.
I like to make my shells with a lot of noise. We paint in the sky.
Everything has something to do with La Familia.
I love the Pazzinis. I just don't know if I can be one anymore.
Tonight, I thought we'd have a family dinner.
Make Everything right has something to do with La Familia, Bob.
Correct. Yes. And it also has that particular film. That's the only one that we're showing that's
In English.
Yes. And it has a lot to do with fireworks. I programmed it last because that's the closest to the 4th of July that we can get. And deals with an Italian family that produces fireworks here in the United States.
So you know that in this hour we've been talking about immigrants and refugees, people moving their lives to the United States. And I can't help but think about the powerful experience it has been for anyone of Italian heritage to have known the family history, known the stories, known the recipes, known the language, make the meals. But I don't get the sense that it was that powerful in your family of origin. You picked up on it later in life.
I did, yes. I probably spent the first 40 years of my life not knowing very much about anything Italian except maybe Italian food,
right,
which I always liked. But I did get involved around my 40th birthday. I read a book called Blood of My Blood by Richard Gambino, and the subtitle of it was The Dilemma of the Italian Americans. And as I was reading it, I saw all sorts of things that echoed from my family experiences. And one thing led to another. I got involved. And at one point, when I was a reporter at the Sacramento Bee, I wrote an article, had nothing to do with Italians, but my byline was Bob Mazzullo. And this gentleman who I did not know, Bill Cerruti, said, I'm starting this organization, the Italian Cultural Society, and I think you might be interested.
And
I have been involved ever since.
Yeah. All these years later. Well,
you know, Beth, I would like to say one other thing. We haven't told people where the Italian Center is. It's at 6821 Fair Oaks Boulevard. That's in Carmichael, and it's on the edge of Carmichael Park. It's in an office complex.
It's lovely. My husband and I have
beautiful
come
center,
to join
yes.
you. And
yeah, I hope you do it
watched
again.
Watched a movie there, and it all starts Friday night. So
tomorrow night, yes. And admission is by donation. We suggest $15, but we'll take whatever you want to pay. And all of the other films are same thing. Open to everybody.
We'll post a link so that everybody can see the films, the dates. It's hard to remember how to program it.
Right. Yeah, I was going to suggest that people could go to the website for the Italian Cultural Society, which would give them not only information about the film program, but about every other activity that the society has. And that is a simple web address. It is italiancenter.net. Italian Center is one word.
We'll post it on our website. Bob, thanks. It's a pleasure.
Beth, thank you very much and a pleasure to be here again.
Great to see you. That is Bob Mazzullo. The information will be at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Sacramento's Red Museum hosts a DIY music festival this weekend. It's called Red X Volume 2. You might not know the Red Museum or some of the terrific local performers that will be on stage. So Sound Advice this week is a preview. In the studio with me, Red Museum co-founders Jennifer Jackson. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
And Brett Loper. Hi, Brett.
Hello.
Glad to have you both back with us.
Thank you.
So for that FYI, what is Red Museum, Jennifer?
Well, the Red Museum is a warehouse in downtown Sacramento that we've converted into a DIY art space. So we have artists and musicians that use the space all year to create their art. And then sometimes we throw events. And this is our second annual fundraiser to help us keep operating throughout the year and keep providing events and unique experiences for the community.
Here's a bit of the music you'll hear this weekend. Let's go to the first clip, and we'll talk about it in a moment. Right, Brett, we've got everybody dancing. You're on.
That was the artist Tino Drima, and the song was called I Want to Be Your Mantra. They're San Francisco-based sextet led by Gregory DiMartino, and they're on the local label Friendship Fever, and they have a little bit more of an indie rock bent. I think one of the more singular features of Tino Drima is DiMartino's yelpy howl, which somehow manages to toe this line between the charisma of doo-wop and the grit of garage rock.
Can you try to do it? Can you try to do the howl?
I won't.
Oh, not on air. Come on.
I've heard it. I know he can.
You know he can?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I think he can too. So the festival is between 3 and 11 this Saturday at the Red Museum. Do you know the times for the bands that we're going to talk about?
We do. Okay. And the list, I think, will be on the website at that time.
So Tino Drima is?
I think they're at 5 o'clock. 5 or 5:30. Sorry.
Somewhere in that region.
All right. Let's hear a little more music.
In this tunnel, there's a light, but it's shining on the other side of time. But now it's standing, I'm all right. Yeah, got me one good place I can hide.
That's Trey Burt. What else?
Trey Burt and his tune called Franklin's Tunnel. Over the course of the last year or so, he's kind of morphed into Sacramento's de facto troubadour. And like the best troubadours of the past, he kind of weds this arresting and visceral like narrative style on his songs.
We're kind of excited about him. He's going to debut his first full-length album with us on November 2nd.
You're in for a real treat. He's got a really compelling stage presence and kind of like exudes this wisdom well beyond his years.
Mm. Cool. All right, next clip. Going out on a limb here, but it sounds like a good nighttime band.
That's right.
They're our headliner.
Great. Yeah, we're really excited about Sherry Glazer. That song's had $10. They are actually from LA, and they just got named Best Indie Band in LA by LA Weekly.
Isn't that funny how you can feel it?
Yeah.
You just feel it in the music.
Yeah.
So absolutely.
We're really excited. The lead singer, Clementine Creevy, is like this amazing feminist icon, and she's collaborated with Death Grips and Tyler the Creator and a lot of artists across spectrums outside of music too. So we're really excited that her energy is going to be there.
That is Jennifer Jackson. I'm also talking with Brett Loper. They are co-founders of the Red Museum in Sacramento, hosting this Artist's Warehouse concert. It is Saturday night, 3 to 11. Let's hear a little more music. Before 10 a.m.
That's great. That'll wake you up, won't it?
All right. So that's Drug Apartments?
That's Drug Apartments. Yeah. They're a Sacramento-based noise rock quartet, and they're fronted by this incendiary songstress named Winnie Kepshall. And Drug Apartment sets at the Red Museum are these really cathartic experiences.
Good word for it.
Yes. Yeah. It's a lot of kinetic energy, and you're kind of exhausted by the end of it in the most sublime of ways.
Okay, well, I'm not yet, so I could probably take a little bit more. But hey, we have one more band to feature and one more clip, so let's go to the music. Somebody is saying, I know that sound. That band has been on with Nick Bruner on Hey Listen.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that was Make Believe. He is a local electronic musician named Skylar Peterson, and he kind of infuses this colorful production style that's very meticulous and detail-oriented with these auto-tune vocals. And what I really like about his music is that he sometimes the electronic aesthetic can kind of be a little alienating, but he executes it with this humanity and grace that I kind of feel like you can call his own.
Colorful is a good word. There is a friendliness, too, like an invitation to the music.
Just like him.
Yeah.
I think that was from the Tiny Desk submission, too, to the Tiny Desk concert contest hosted by NPR. So what's the rest of the atmosphere around the music, Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually... there's a lot of experiences going on. We have some art installations. We have an artist who's a sculpture student at Sac State, Chris Duffy. He's going to be doing a 24-hour build of these larger-than-life wooden sculptures.
Wow.
We'll also have the Road Virus, which is a bus that's converted into a kind of alternative reading library experience. And they're going to be there.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm going to say one more time, it's at the Red Museum. It's the Red X Volume 2, Saturday from 3 to midnight. We'll post links on the website because you have a lot of space for a lot of people.
We do.
That's right.
Thank you so much for bringing the music and a little chance to talk about Red Museum.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
Jennifer Jackson and Brett Loper. And that's this week's Sound Advice. In fact, that's Insight for this week. There'll be special programming tomorrow, and we're back with a live show on Monday. Thanks to Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, Bert Johnson, Mark Jones, Anthony Van Hook today. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us.